The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Now, here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today I'm going to focus on the acidosis rodeo case that we actually did in December. That was part one. I've had a lot of emails regarding this case. A lot of people have wanted to utilize this in their actual agency as education, and that's really, really great. I'm really happy that it was well received. If we remember back to that case, that was a very complex case, and there's a lot of things that we have to kind of look at. I've actually talked about this case with different physicians, and one of the physicians that I've talked to the most is a good friend of mine and actually a national medical director for Air Methods, a scientific advisor, Dr. Dan Davis, very brilliant doctor, in my mind, smartest doctor I've ever talked to. I'm sure there's other brilliant doctors out there, obviously. But, you know, there's just no question that I can't ask him that he's able to articulate a in-depth answer, which is an amazing thing. So I really, really appreciate his guidance in things like this. And I think this case is very interesting. When we think back at this case, remember this patient was a 38-year-old male, had a history of nausea, vomiting, weakness, has a history of hypertension, so no other history related to this patient that would, you know, make us have a kind of different look at differential diagnosis. So just hypertension. Has a glucose of 1,034, if you remember. ABG, the patient was in a severe metabolic acidosis, partially compensated. So pH of 6.97, PCO2 of 17, bicarb of 5, and a base excess of negative 23. Few things I want to clear up. When I listen to the acidosis rodeo part one, it's amazing the little things you kind of hear. You let it kind of digest and you go back and you listen to it a few months later. And there was a few things that I noticed I misspoke on. And the first thing is using interchangeable terms as in base excess and base deficit. And I kind of messed that up a few times. One of the things we have to understand is what is a base excess? Well, a base excess is related to base, right? So alkalosis. So if we had a positive number, that would be related to an alkalosis state. If it's a base excess with a negative number, what that means is that we have an acidosis. When we think about base excess, or we say base excess of negative 23, that also means we have a base deficit because we're in a negative number. So when you say a base deficit, you don't say negative 23. You just say we have a base deficit of 23. And I think I misspoke a few times, so I wanted to clear that up. The other area that I messed up on, and I don't have any clue what I was thinking, I actually put a tweet out related to this because I wanted to correct this immediately, and that was all the way back at AMTC that I talked about that, was the insulin infusion. And I think I said an insulin dose of 0.5 units per kilo per hour. That's a massive dose. That is incorrect. It's actually 0.1 units per kilo per hour. And then we'll talk about when do you reduce that down even further in relation to blood sugar levels. So I wanted to clear those two things up. Where we left off with kind of identifying, and I think I said, let's look at DKA and compare it to HHNK, and what are the differences between the two? If we look at HHNK first, what does that mean? That means it's a hyperosmolar, hyperglycemic, non-ketotic acidosis, or non-ketoacidosis. There's some very important aspects to HHNK, and the big one that you often hear of or focus on is the blood sugar level. The blood sugar levels in a HHNK versus DKA are much different, and the HHNK patient will have sugar levels that will exceed 1,000. So the range is usually 800 to 2,000. And we know that DKA patients do not get that high, most of them. I mean, I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, but for the most part, they do not get that high. Well, this patient obviously has a sugar of 1,034, so definitely kind of falls in line with that HHNK, even though this patient does not have a type 2 diabetes, you know, history. So what are the causes? Well, having an underlying disease process of type 2 diabetes, this patient doesn't have that. We also have to understand that this patient is going to be extremely, extremely dehydrated. So your initial focus on this patient is going to be fixing the dehydration. We said that type 2 diabetes is a primary cause. What are some other causes? Elderly patients, they have a tired pancreas. Their pancreas isn't just working efficiently. They often will present with HHNK. Newly undiagnosed type 2 diabetics don't have any idea that they're in that state. Infection. And so those patients that are on TPN, patients that are in nursing homes, long-standing feeding tubes, patients like that, we know TPN and those lines used for TPN, those are a big, big cause of infection. Pancreatitis. Pancreatitis with an associated HHNK has a 95% mortality rate. So that's a bad, bad clinical sign. Patients that are on thiazides, and so think about those diuretics, those patients hold on to glucose. And so those patients can definitely present with HHNK. Patients that are on chronic steroids, these patients, think about asthma patients, COPD patients. Those patients become resistant to insulin, and so obviously they're going to have an increase in glucose levels. But the big, big cause is infection. 30 to 60% of patients will actually present with HHNK based on a primary infection of urinary tract, so UTIs, pneumonia, are the most common reasons why patients will present and kind of progress to that HHNK state. If we go back to our patient, again, this patient had a base excess of negative 23, or again, it said a base deficit of 23. Sugar was 1,034. So what are some other things to kind of consider? Well, remember, this patient had a white blood cell count of 27,000. There's other reasons why patients can have a high white blood cell count, but that's a pretty high count. Always be thinking infection. We talked about lactate levels, diagnosing sepsis, right? Lactate is not a diagnostic indicator for sepsis. Lactate is a indicator of stress. We talked about procalcitonin and procalcitonin levels. That is a great indicator. It's a newer lab used to diagnose a bacterial infection related to increased inflammatory markers. So we can utilize that. And then think about stress responses, right? Our stress response associated with lots of different maybe mediators can actually cause HHNK. So when we think about HHNK, there are some things that we have in this case that we can kind of start ruling out or utilizing. If you remember, our ABG was a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. We had a 6.9 pH. One of the things we have to understand about pH is it's very rare. It's more rare than you would think to have a severe metabolic acidosis with a pH less than 7.0. That's where we're going to get into part three when we start looking at the cat mud piles mnemonic and all the different differential diagnosis indicators related to that mnemonic. That's where you're actually going to see that patient with a pH less than 7.0. And it really comes back to, in most cases, three main diseases or presentations. And that's ethylene glycol poisoning, an aspirin overdose patient, and then a patient in DKA. So those are the three primary reasons why patients get so acidotic that their pH drops less than 7.0. For the most part, patients are going to stay above 7.0. So when we go back to HHNK, we look at the primary presentation associated with HHNK. These patients normally don't get severely acidotic. Actually, their pH usually stays above 7.3. But we have to remember, why does that happen? What happens because they still have insulin. They're not breaking down the fatty acids for energy like you see in DKA. And if they do have an acidosis, it's usually related to a secondary lactic acidosis. It's not a ketoacidosis. So completely different kind of presentation. Patients in DKA get severely acidotic. Those patients get that pH less than 7.0 because of the severe ketoacidosis, because of the fatty acid breakdown. HHNK patients don't have that phenomenon. And so their blood sugar levels will, again, be 800 to 2,000. But this occurs due to no development of ketones and no acidosis. Again, they can eventually present with that lactic acidosis. But if we think back to infection, remember 30 to 60% of patients that have an associated infection will be related to a UTI. We see that a lot in our nursing home patients, or pneumonia. So it's not a cause and effect type of an issue. This patient definitely that we're looking at, even though very young, could definitely have an HHNK and definitely have a severe metabolic acidosis and a sugar of over 1,000. But are they all related? They all could be kind of based on different aspects. And that's where we're going to really dive in. That's where we have to be that detective, that investigator, and kind of look at why are all these things happening. They may not all be related. So if we go back to our look at HHNK, the other negative factor of this disease is the presentation takes longer. The symptoms take longer to present. And so individuals will seem a lot sicker than what you may see in other illnesses. We have to also remember, why do these patients become so dehydrated? Well, their glucose gets so high. I mean, imagine somebody with a glucose over 1,000. And glucose is a hyperosmolar molecule. And we know hyperosmolar, think of a hyperosmolar type of a fluid. What do we use a hypertonic solution for? We use that hypertonic solution to pull water from the cell. So if glucose is hyperosmolar, we actually pull volume from the cell and we become cellularly dehydrated. The key thing with these patients, as I said, is initial fluid replacement. So at least 1 or 2 liters of isotonic fluid needs to be given, whether that's normal saline or LR. And after about 2 hours, you need to switch to a half normal saline. That's going to start really building that volume back into the cell. And so we know half normal saline is going to shift volume into the cell. You're going to start having good cellular hydration. Where we focus on the blood sugar, right? We need to start looking at a continuous insulin infusion. That insulin infusion needs to be at the dose that I said before, so that's 0.1 units per kilo per hour. But once we get that blood sugar down to about 300, we need to lower that insulin dose to actually a half of that, so 0.05 units per kilo per hour, and really, really watch that blood sugar. The same goes for HHNK and DKA related to how quickly we drop that sugar. We never want to drop it more than 100 per hour or 50 per 30 minutes. So same thing goes. What about our potassium? Potassium replacement. If these patients are severely dehydrated, they definitely could have a hypokalemia. So we have to really watch that closely. So replacement should start with a potassium of less than 5. And we need to always think about the rehydration aspect. If we rehydrate somebody, and this is really in any situation, a lot of these measurements are based on a concentration. So what's the concentration of sodium or chloride or anything related to the solution? If we add more solution and we have the same amount of chloride or sodium or potassium, your solution is going to become greater and your element is going to stay the same, so it's going to drop it. And so we have to always remember to look at that really, really closely. So hypokalemia at the onset of rehydration requires up to 60 milliequivalents per liter to correct the serum potassium concentration. So we have to really, really watch that We also have to remember, what is a primary response to metabolic acidosis? Well, because of the shifting in and out of the cell, because of the hydrogen ions shifting into the cell, we have potassium that shifts out of the cell. So a normal presentation in a severe metabolic acidosis is going to be a hyper state of potassium. If we have a hyper state of potassium, always look at that metabolic acidosis as the cause. Fix the metabolic acidosis and that potassium should drop. In an HHNK state, because of the severe dehydration, most often you're not going to have that high K. You're actually going to have that low K. So we need to watch that K very, very closely. We need to, you know, check that every couple hours. So that's the major kind of differential look at HHNK. We've got a little bit of difference seen in DKA, but there's some significant kind of teaching points that we're going to focus on. If we go back to our case with a sugar of over 1,000, he's got a white count of 28,000, severe metabolic acidosis. Some of these things that he's presenting with don't really fit that HHNK based on what we just talked about. So let's dive into the DKA and see if we can kind of match up anything related to that differential. With DKA, we have essentially a shortage of insulin. We have a blood sugar levels kind of range from 350 to 700. Different texts may say some different numbers, but that's probably pretty close. What are some diagnostic indicators of DKA? Well, ketones. Ketones, that's a huge thing. Do we have ketone production? If you have ketones greater than 5 milliequivalents per liter, if you have a glucose level greater than 250, and you have a pH less than 7.3, those are big, big indicators. And then looking at the bicarb, do we have a metabolic derangement? Is that bicarb less than 18? So that's, you know, obviously your normal range of bicarb is 22 to 26, but when we get down to less than 18, we utilize all these indicators. Again, ketones greater than 5 milliequivalents per liter, a glucose level greater than 250, and that pH that's going to be less than 7.3 with an associated bicarb that's less than 18. Let's focus on the ketones. Ketones, again, are a byproduct of fatty acid breakdown. So how does that work? Well, when our body feels like the insulin levels are not sufficient, we have a shortage of insulin. Our body starts burning through stored fats in order to compensate for that. And so that's where we have fatty acid breakdown, that's where we have ketone production, and we get into a ketoacidosis. That's actually why our sugar levels, our glucose levels in DKA are not as high as HHNK. The ketoacidosis or the ketone production, the fatty acid breakdown, actually keeps those glucose levels lower. We also have to realize that patients in DKA can have a fruity odor. That's based on the ketone production. But not everybody can smell ketones. So we have to be very careful not to utilize that ketone smell, that fruity odor that's on somebody's breath as an indicator, because we can't all smell that. So let's look at the compensation side. If we go back to the ABG, this patient is in a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. I talk about this a lot in our review courses. And if you remember in part one, I talked about a new concept that I'm teaching called the 3 P's of end-tidal CO2, that we don't ever make a ventilator change until we identify or rule out those as causes. We have to remember the relation between end-tidal CO2 and PCO2, that your end-tidal CO2 will never be higher than your PCO2. So on this ABG of a pH of 6.97, our CO2 is 17, we know that our end-tidal has to be less than 17. We've got a bicarb of 5. So because our CO2 is less than 35, we have a respiratory alkalosis associated with this. So that's called a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. Normal compensation, and I discussed this in part one, your CO2 will always go opposite in relation to your bicarb. So if our bicarb is low, bicarb is an indicator of base. We have a low amount of bicarb. Our CO2 is an indicator of acid. If our CO2 is low, that means we have a low amount of acid on the CO2 side. If our bicarb is low, that means we have a low amount of base, we have a high amount of acid. So they're going opposite directions. So our normal compensation is going to be related to exactly that. Our respiratory side kicks in. We know that's the second by second type of buffering system. And it produces a respiratory alkalosis in an attempt to hold that pH right where it's at. Remember, there's an inverse relationship between pH and CO2. For every 10 millimeters of mercury, a change in CO2, our pH can change by 0.08 in the opposite direction. So that's our body's way of protecting that pH so it doesn't get any lower. If we go back to our kind of respiratory compensation side, these DKA patients will have Kussmaul respirations. Kussmaul respirations, that's that rapid, shallow breathing. And again, it's an attempt to blow off the CO2 to make sure that pH does not drop any lower. If we remember from our first case, we identified that this patient's CO2 compensation was essentially maxed out. And if you don't remember that, go back and listen to part one. I go through how to look at CO2 compensation and identify if we're maxed out or do we have any extra that we can kind of, our body can add to protect this patient. What about the aspects of serum osmolality? We know that shifting water in and out of the cell is based on, you know, our different states. Our body's going to shift water in and out of the cell, and that's essentially cellular hydration. Essentially, a normal serum OS is going to be around 290-ish. So the higher that number gets, the more cellularly dehydrated we are. So it's kind of opposite of what you would think. These patients, as we said it with HHNK, DKA patients are also very dehydrated. They're always very volume depleted because of the high sugar amount in our bloodstream. Ends up getting into our bloodstream and causes us excessive urination. So these patients will have excessive urination. It'll produce excessive thirst. That's where we start seeing these patients, you know, days after the initial presentation to DKA, they're going to present and they'll initially, based on that severe metabolic acidosis, as I said, that K will rise. We're going to get a hyper K state. But because of the excessive urination, slowly that K will start dropping because we're peeing it all off. So we have to also remember potassium loss through the urine and that shift from intercellular to extracellular due to acidosis. So we're going to start peeing all that off. We're going to get that loss. And so you're going to eventually have a low K state in that DKA patient as well. So what about this patient? Well, remember the sodium. The sodium level for this patient was low. And we have to also correct for that sodium. So this is called a pseudo-hyponatremia. And we have to think about that because we don't want to replace that sodium. That sodium is low because of the sugar being so high. Remember, we did a corrected sodium. That corrected sodium formula is sodium plus our glucose level minus 100 multiplied by 0.016. So essentially what we have is we've got the inner parentheses. We have glucose minus 100. That's what we do first. So our glucose was 1,034. Subtract 100. That gives you 934. We do 934 multiplied by 0.016. That gives us 14.944. And then we're going to take our sodium and we're going to add it to that. So our sodium was 126 plus 14.944 equals 140.9. So essentially, we just identified that the sodium was falsely low based on that sugar. There's no need to replace sodium by improving and fixing this DKA by dropping the sugar, or I should say by dropping the sugar unrelated to DKA or HHNK, just the sugar in general, that sodium will correct itself. As we said in the other disease process, HHNK, once we get that glucose down, right, we want to slowly bring that down. Our glucose levels for DKA are not going to be as high. So watch those really, really closely. no more than 100 per hour, no more than 50 per 30 minutes. But once we get that less than 250 for a DKA patient, that's where we're going to reduce our insulin to 0.05 units per kilo per hour. So less than 250 for DKA, less than 300 for HHNK. So that's a big synopsis based on these two very complex disease processes. Both of these are very, very important to kind of understand. I think it's really easy to always blame everything on DKA, but there's some very definitive things we have to take from the differences. The two big ones to focus on is usually in the initial presentation, HHNK patients, remember, are not going to be that acidotic. They're not going to become acidotic based on that presentation. They may have a lactic acid issue. They may have something like that that causes a low pH state. But again, remember, oftentimes those HHNK patients are going to become HHNK because of an infectious process. We know the elderly patients, their pancreases are not working effectively. Patients with uncontrolled diabetes, type 2, or maybe an undiagnosed situation, and those patients that are on TPN. Those are going to be the patients related. So you can utilize that as your history, kind of questions to the physician, to the nursing staff, or look at their paperwork and try to get an idea. Remember, long use of steroids or thiazide medications, so those diuretics. Those diuretics hold on to glucose. If we go back to our case and we look at this from the perspective of why is that anion gap so high? If you remember, that anion gap was 49. So let's go back to our patient and remember they had a couple other things that were out of whack. When we go back to this patient and we say, what other indicators could we look at and try to utilize as our differential diagnosis endpoints? Remember, the anion gap was 49. In DKA, the whole treatment is guided around closing that gap, getting that gap to normal. Remember, an anion gap should be less than, you know, different literature says 9, less than 8, something like that, you know. So we want to get that low. So you want to close that gap. Well, this patient has an anion gap of 49. There's lots of different reasons why patients can have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. And this patient's definitely in that severe metabolic acidosis range. So why would this patient be in that state? How do we calculate an anion gap? If you want to review that, remember that's chloride plus your bicarb. Remember, bicarb on the Chem7 is listed as a CO2. So it'd be chloride plus your CO2. Take that number, subtract it from your sodium. Our sodium was 126. Our chloride was 80. Our CO2 was 3. So it's going to be 80 plus 3, so 83, minus 126. It's going to be 43. And then you're going to add your potassium back onto it. Your potassium was 8. So this patient was in a high potassium state. So based on the labs we were given, our anion gap was actually 59. If you remember, the ABG from part one showed an anion gap of 49. So it actually gave you a calculated anion gap. So very, very close. So we calculated the anion gap based on our labs on our Chem7, which we can always do. But based on the ABG, we were just a few points different. Either way, we have a huge anion gap. That doesn't usually match. You are going to have a potential high anion gap in DKA. You're probably not going to have that high of an anion gap in HHNK. But remember, is that HHNK related to an infection, right? So we're going down a completely different pathway. It's not a cause and effect thing. Your HHNK is a result of the infection. That infection is causing a lactic acidosis. It may cause a sepsis. It may cause an ARDS. So we're dealing with multiple different pathophysiologies here, and we've got to correct the underlying issue. If it's an infectious process, we've got to fix the infectious process. That's going to eventually fix the HHNK by correcting the infection. So that's going to kind of segue into part three. High anion gap acidoses are most often due to ketoacidosis, lactic acidosis, renal failure, or certain toxic ingestions. So if you remember, we kind of talked about looking at that base excess. Remember that base excess was negative 23 or a base deficit of 23. And trying to identify where are those acids coming from. You look at the sodium. You look at the chloride. You look at the difference between the two. Remember, those are both strong acids. You continue down. You look at the albumin. We do a corrected albumin. Remember, albumin can either falsely increase the base deficit or it can falsely elevate. We then look at our lactate. Once you get down past the lactate, that's where you're going to get into those toxic alcohols. So that's kind of where we're at this point. That's looking at what's called an osmolar gap. So we have a high anion gap, 49 to 51, based on whatever calculation you utilize, whether that's the ABG or our calculation based on the Chem7 panel. And that's going to segue into part three. So come join me for part three. Part three, we're going to focus on the mnemonic cat mud piles. As I said, very deep content. Lots of really cool stuff. I've learned a lot. And hopefully we can get some type of indication of why this patient is presenting. We may not be able to identify it based on the information. Again, I was only given certain aspects of this case. But I think it'll be really, really fun to dive deep into these really severe metabolic acidoses, things that we don't always see, always think about, things that you should be talking to your partner about. You know, there's a lot of dead time a lot of times in our flights. If you're working at a base where you're flying, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, you may not have as much dead time, but that's not always the case. A lot of times I think the average transport time, HEMS-wise, is 20 to 40 minutes. I think that's pretty average. Once you get all your treatment aspects taken care of, it's really good to talk about, you know, what are we missing? What are some things that we can change? And going through your different differential diagnosis. One of my good buddies that I've flown with, and I think he's absolutely one of the best at this, and loved flying with him. And I think that we really clicked. It was James Allison. James Allison is a flight nurse, works for Air Methods Kentucky 2 in Mount Sterling. Phenomenal nurse. And I loved that we were able to, you know, get all of our treatment done and then sit back and be humble enough to say, all right, we did this, 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 and this, but have we missed anything? And start going through these differential diagnoses. It may clue you into, oh, well, you know, we missed this. Maybe we should be treating it this way. And I think he's really, really good at doing that and not just sitting back and, you know, twiddling your thumbs. And so I got to give him a lot of credit for that. And I loved flying with him because we were able to kind of nerd out, as I say. So, you know, all respect to James Allison. That's all I got for this case. If you have any questions related to the case, you want other information, please email me at eric.bauer@flightbridgehead.com. I will get back to you immediately. And again, if you want to attend one of our review courses, if you want to have a ventilator workshop, please email me. We've got courses scheduled out now until the first part, winter, spring-ish of 2018. Lots of dates on the calendar. So, you know, check that out. Go to the website. If you don't see anything that is close to you, reach out to me. All it takes is you reaching out to me and putting a date on the calendar if you feel like there's need in your area, and we will travel to you. And so until next time, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education. For more, visit flightbridgeed.com.